right. Welcome to the Deep Dive, everybody. We're here to, as always, take a really close look at some fascinating material. And today we're doing something a little different.
Yeah.
We're going to be diving deep, no pun intended, into two separate legal cases.
Uh-huh.
That both have the same name. And I know that sounds a little strange, but stick with it. It's going to be really interesting. We're going to see how these two cases, both called Doremus, offer some really, really fascinating insights into how constitutional law works in the U.S., especially for all of you law students out there who are, you know, really trying to get a grasp on this stuff. So we've got the first case, United States versus Doremus, from way back in 1919.
That's right.
This one really digs into this question of, like, just how much power does the federal government have, especially when it comes to regulating drugs?
Yeah.
And they kind of did it through this whole idea of taxation. So think about it. We've got odd doctor. He's selling heroin. And this one act just blows up into this huge constitutional debate, you know, a debate that's still going on in a lot of ways today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it's not like we're looking at some legal dynasty here, right? It's just this wild coincidence.
Right.
We've got these two cases with the same name, but it gives us this awesome chance to explore, like, two totally separate areas of law.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's start with that 1919 Doremus case. You know, we're talking about federal power, drug regulation, all under this umbrella of taxes.
Okay, so let's break down this 1919 Doremus situation a bit. You know, what were the basic facts of the case? What even led to this big constitutional showdown?
Okay, so at the heart of it all, we've got this guy, Dr. Doremus. He's a physician. He's registered under the Harrison Narcotic Drug Act of 1914. So this is, you know, right in the early days of federal drug regulation.
Okay.
Now, here's the thing. He goes and sells some heroin, right? But he doesn't use those required federal order forms, the ones that are, you know, mandated by the act.
Ah, so he's skipping some paperwork. Classic.
Yeah, you could say that. But it's a little more than just, you know, forgetting to file a form. The indictment actually alleged that he was giving this heroin to someone who was addicted, and it wasn't for any legit medical purpose.
Oh, so it wasn't just a bureaucratic thing then.
Right.
The government was questioning whether this drug deal was even legal in the first place.
Exactly.
So this brings us to that really big constitutional question.
Yeah.
Did Congress overstep its boundaries here?
That's the million-dollar question, right. The whole issue was whether Congress, by passing this Harrison Act, had gone beyond what the Constitution actually allows them to do.
Right.
Was this federal government trying to regulate narcotics when that should have been left to the states? Like, traditionally, things like health and safety, that's been the state's job, right? And the other thing is, the act was set up as this way to raise money, you know, bring in revenue. So was Congress really using its power to tax just mm-hmm. as this sneaky way to regulate something they weren't supposed to?
That's a really good point. So how did the court justify this? You know, it seems like they were using the power to tax to kind of indirectly control drug sales. How did they get away with that?
Well, the majority opinion of the Supreme Court, they leaned really hard on this idea of what some call the taxing power nexus. Basically, their logic was this. You've got registration for anyone who's dealing with these narcotics, right? And then you've got these mandatory order forms. Those two things together, they're tied directly to the government's power to get taxes from these sales. By keeping track of every single transaction, they could pretty much shut down any tax evasion when it comes to narcotics. So those order forms, they weren't just some random bureaucratic hurdle. The court saw them as this essential tool to make sure everyone was paying their taxes.
So those boring order forms, they were actually the key.
Yeah, pretty much. And the court, they went even further. They emphasized what they called a legitimate revenue purpose. By making sure that these drugs were only being sold for real accepted medical reasons, the act indirectly helped with tax enforcement because, you know, it made it easier to spot those illegal sales where people weren't paying taxes. So the main point the court made was this. Even if this act had a big impact on regulation, and it definitely did, as long as it was designed, even in some small way, to bring in tax money, it was totally within Congress's power to make it a law. They weren't buying the argument that this was something that only the states should be dealing with.
Wow, that's a pretty broad interpretation of what the federal government can do with its taxing power. I mean, did everyone on the court agree with that?
Oh, absolutely not. We had Chief Justice White, a big name on the court, and he wrote a really strong dissenting opinion, and several other justices agreed with him. His main point was this. The Harrison Act, Even though it looked like it was about taxes, it was really just a way to control how drugs were being distributed. It wasn't really about getting more money for the government. He argued that Congress was basically using the power to tax as this excuse to stick their nose into things that should be left to the states to decide, you know, like public health, safety, morality, all that stuff. He thought this was a total overreach, going way beyond what the Constitution allowed, all under the guise of, oh, we're just collecting taxes.
So what's the big takeaway here for our listeners? You know, we've got all these law students out there. Why should they care about a case from 1919 about, you know, heroin?
This case, it set a really important precedent. It showed that the federal government can find ways to regulate behavior through taxes, even when it doesn't seem directly related to bringing in money. Think about it. This whole idea, it's come up in so many cases since then, even in those legal battles about the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it really shows that the relationship between the federal government and the states is constantly changing, and sometimes it gets pretty tense. United States versus Doremus, it's like this foundational case for understanding how federal power has expanded and how important that necessary and proper clause is. You know, the one that says Congress can make laws that help them carry out their specific powers, like the power to tax. The big thing to remember here is that Congress can get creative and use taxes to regulate things, even if their main goal isn't just to get more cash.
Okay, that was a great breakdown of that first Doremus case. But get ready for a sharp turn here. We've got our second case, and again, same name, but this time it looks like we're dealing with a different guy, Robert Doremus. And this case dives into a whole different area of constitutional law.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about the Fifth Amendment, the one that protects you from incriminating yourself and your right to a fair trial. So set the stage for us. What happened in this case?
All right. So this later Doremus case, all about this guy, Robert Doremus, he got convicted of, get this, impersonating a U.S. Marshal. Can you believe that?
Wow.
Yeah, pretty bold move. The prosecution said he went around flashing a fake badge, claiming he was a marshal, and then signed a made-up name on this release form, all to bust his son out of federal prison. Now, here's where it gets interesting. He takes the stand in court, right? Denies everything. And the judge, right there in front of the jury, orders him to give a handwriting sample. And not just any sample, he had to write the exact same words that were on that release form. And of course, the government brought in their handwriting expert, who then testified that, yep, the sample from the courtroom matched the signature on the release form.
That sounds like some pretty solid evidence tying him to that fake signature.
So where's the legal issue here? Why did Doremus think this handwriting sample thing was violating his rights? The big question was, did making Doremus give that handwriting sample right there in front of everyone, did that violate his Fifth Amendment rights? The one that says you don't have to testify against yourself, right? Or did it mess with his right to a fair trial? His argument was that they were basically forcing him to give evidence that would be used to convict him.
Makes sense. So what did the court decide? Did they agree that his rights were violated?
The court said, nope, no violation here. And they based their decision on two big legal ideas. The first one is this thing called waiver of privilege. Basically, the court said that when Doremus decided to get up on that witness stand and testify, he kind of gave up his Fifth Amendment protection, at least when it came to stuff that was relevant to the case he was presenting.
So by speaking up for himself, he opened the door to more questions.
And even actions. Yeah. The court's logic was, once he decided to tell his side of the story, he couldn't then just refuse to give info that was connected to the facts of the case. The second part of the court's reasoning was what they called the fair trial test. They said that even if a defendant gives up their right against self-incrimination by testifying, anything the court makes them do still has to meet two conditions. One, it has to be relevant to the case, and two, it can't be something that humiliates them or is unfairly prejudicial. You know, it's something that would make the jury biased against them.
Got it. So in this case, with Doremus and the handwriting sample, the court thought it met both of those conditions.
Exactly. The court said that the handwriting sample was totally relevant. It directly connected to the idea that he had forged the signature on the release form, which is what the prosecution was trying to prove. And they didn't think taking a handwriting sample was something that would degrade him or be insulting. To show the difference, they often compare it to stuff that would be considered unfair, like making a defendant act out the crime they supposedly committed. That would be seen as pressuring them, almost like a performance, and it could sway the jury based on their emotions instead of the facts. The court was basically saying, look, if it's important to the case, you've got to answer those questions. But they also wanted to make sure things stayed fair.
That makes sense. So for our listeners who are studying to be lawyers, what's the big lesson they should take away from this second Doremus case?
Well, there are a couple of really important things to think about. First of all, it shows that a defendant has to think really carefully about whether or not to testify. If you decide to get up on that stand, you're opening yourself up to cross-examination and maybe even having to do things right there in court that are related to the charges against you. Second, it reminds us that that Fifth Amendment protection, it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. There are times when you can give up that protection. And lastly, it shows how the courts try to find a balance. They need evidence to have a trial, but the defendant still deserves a fair process. They don't want the prosecution turning the courtroom into some dramatic show that could unfairly influence the jury.
It's amazing that these two cases, connected only by their name, explore such different parts of constitutional law. As we wrap up this deep dive, what are the big connections, the key themes that tie these two seemingly separate cases together?
That's a really great question. They might be about different areas of law, but both of these dual Doremus decisions, they highlight a central idea in our legal system, balancing power. The 1919 case is all about the power struggle between the federal government and the states. The handwriting case, it's about the power of the state in the court system versus the rights of the person accused of a crime, specifically that right against self-incrimination and the right to a fair trial.
So to simplify it even more, what's one crucial nuance from each case that our listeners should really keep in mind?
From that 1919 Doremus case, it's understanding that fine line between taxation and regulation. It can be tricky, but just because a law affects how things are regulated, it doesn't automatically mean it's an illegal use of the power to tax. As long as there's a logical connection to bringing in money for the government, it can be considered constitutional. And from the handwriting case, it's realizing that even though testifying can mean giving up some of your Fifth Amendment protections, you're still protected from being forced to do things that would make the jury unfairly prejudiced against you. The courts are there to make sure things stay fair. They don't want the courtroom to become a circus.
Those are great points to remember. So as we send all of you listeners back to your casebooks and your studies, here's a final thought to consider. How do these two Doremus decisions, one about the government regulating drugs and the other about individual rights in court, how do they shape how you understand the government's ability to influence what people do and the limits on our rights when we're caught up in legal proceedings today? It's a question worth thinking about as you continue to explore these really fundamental constitutional principles. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.